County cricket, international cricket, test cricket, franchise cricket, red ball, white ball, 100-ball cricket. At The Cricketer, we care about the cricket you love. And that's why we've launched a brand new app built for fans of the English game. Download The Cricketer app and sign up to our Access All Areas Pass to receive agenda-setting journalism and illuminating storytelling straight to your phone. The latest news from the England camps, a dedicated daily service for fans of the 18 first-class counties, and committed coverage of women's cricket. Download the app today and enjoy 1 month of free unlimited access. The Cricketer. We care about the cricket you love.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast in association with our friends at Bear Cricket. I'm your host, Aaron, aka the Cricket Connoisseur, and on my left for today's special episode of TCCP is none other than Hampshire County Cricket Club lead sports physiotherapist, James Clegg. So James, first things first, mate, thank you very much for joining me here on the podcast today. It's an absolute pleasure to get you on for a chat about all things county cricket. I have to ask, mate, how's your day been so far?
Well, thanks for that introduction, Aaron. It's an honour to be on your show. A bit dull at the moment, Aaron, I'll be honest. I'm isolating. I'm COVID positive at the moment. So I've not seen another human being for about 6 days. So this interaction feels absolute gold. I actually did my hair for the first time and actually tried to present myself to another human being for the first time in what seems like a week. So this is exciting times.
Well, obviously, James, wishing you a quick and full recovery from COVID, first and foremost. And yeah, it's such a shame, isn't it? Especially on the eve of the season. Because, of course, yesterday the boys were in action, weren't they? Pre-season friendly against Gloucestershire. Am I correct in thinking, though, that a couple of the lads came round to your place and gave you a cheeky bit of Marks and Spencers? Got some grocery shopping in?
Yeah, that's very true. The guys played a two-day against Gloucestershire at the Aegeus Bowl, and they were blessed with some very good weather and I think some very good cricket. And it was during our batting innings that I did reach out to a couple of guys. We have a little WhatsApp group with a couple of guys who live in my hometown. And it was a call for help, really, because my groceries were running very low. And I didn't have anything for my evening meal. And Aaron Donald and Ian Holland picked up the call, went to Marks and Spencer's and blessed them and brought me some shopping around last night, which was very kind. And we got to talk cricket and review their days.
Fair play. Can I just say shout out to those two as well? We've had them here on the podcast. We had Nyan very recently, Ian Holland, aka Dutchie or Dingo, whatever you want to call him. We had him on a lot earlier, but yeah, both absolute gems of blokes. And what's the choice of meal then, James? What was the choice on offer last night?
I went for spaghetti bolognese, to be honest, but I had too much beef and not enough sauce, so it wasn't the best bolognese that I've had, but that's not their fault. That's purely my. I did send a little list across, and they delivered it as asked. So it's all got myself to blame. No, I should have ordered two cans of sauce there.
There you go. Some very, very valuable advice coming here from the County Cricket Podcast. You can never have enough sauce. Isn't that correct?
It's cutting edge stuff.
Exactly. This is the insight and analysis that only you can get on this platform, the County Cricket Podcast. So yes, guys, if you are out there making your spaghetti bolognese, don't have dry beef, plenty of sauce. But fortunately, James, we aren't here to talk just about cuisine and culinary skills. I'm not exactly Gordon Ramsay. I can make a sandwich and some beans on toast, but that's about the limits of my cooking ability. So it's a good job that we're here to talk about the wonderful game of cricket instead. And in terms of the content, just for you guys as the listeners, today I'm going to be chatting to James all about his experiences in county cricket down on the South Coast. Of course, we'll delve deeper into the world of sports physiotherapy as well, detail exactly the types of things that are done in that role. And then we'll end today's podcast with some very, very funny Twitter questions. It has to be said, I thoroughly recommend that you stick around for those at the end of today's podcast. But James, before we get into all of that good stuff then, and we unpack your journey in county cricket so far, I want to know a bit more about you, if I may, in terms of the James Clegg origin story. So what were your first ever memories of cricket? either playing or watching this magnificent game?
I think I've got my dad to blame for this. When I was 7 years of age, my dad took me to watch my local cricket team, which is Fairburn in North Yorkshire, to an evening game. And it was during that game I was first in, during that evening I was first experienced my first cricket game, and made a very close friend that I still have to this day. And my relationship with that club has continued all my life to this point. And basically the love of cricket started from that evening match, and it was very much followed up with my dad started taking me to go and watch Yorkshire County Cricket Club at Headingley from the age of 7-8. So we're talking mid-90s here, the old Sunday League, the old coloured kits, and I was just fascinated with the sport, fascinated with the new friends I was earning back at the cricket club that I'd become a member of. And yeah, I became very much a cricket badger very quickly. Started playing the game at junior level, and I was a regular player of the old Telegraph Fantasy Cricket League growing up. No more excitement than on a Friday afternoon after school, going and getting my Telegraph on the way home from the petrol station, and me and my dad going through the scores and working out how our teams had gone on. So it was injected to me as a sport very early indeed, and it's been a massive part of my life, really. But obviously, both professionally but for a long time, non-professionally, I've played cricket very regularly, every Saturday, pretty much throughout my teens, into my adult years, and only really stopped playing or effectively semi-retired as a result of coming into working in professional sport, particularly in cricket, which obviously just completely gazumps your summers. But yeah, it's my number one sport, without a doubt. And I can say I'm a self-proclaimed badger as well.
Absolutely nothing wrong with that term, James. Embrace it. Enjoy it. I am also a fellow cricket badger. You should be proud of it. It's not a bad term at all. And you mentioned that about playing for Fairburn. Shout out to Fairburn as well, because they'll have a lot of mentions in today's podcast. But you joined them at an early age. You've been playing for them since around about the age of 7 then. Did you ever want to become a professional cricketer? Or was cricket for you basically almost like a hobby, a recreational sport? Or did you ever have those aspirations to maybe play for Yorkshire or play for one of the counties or even play for England?
Yes. I think most kids, when they're growing up, have that kind of aspiration. I used to play with my dad mainly in the garden before I could play structured cricket I think it was under 11s was the first kind of structured game I was able to play in. And yeah, I had some early initial success at under 11s level, and you start to think, oh, maybe I can take this somewhere, and got into the league representative side under 13 level, and was in the same side as Tim Bresnan was in the same league representative side I was in. And you start to think, well, maybe I could do okay. But to be honest, I think I was about as good as it got. I was only ever going to be a village cricketer, try and be a good one at that, which people at Fairburn would say I've not achieved that either. But yeah, I played only amateur levels. It was quite clear, probably from the age of, I don't know, 13, 14, that I was never going to be good enough to take it to an elite standard. But that never really, it wasn't one of those where it was, all right, I'm going to change tact. It was, the passion for the sport was there. I was very much indoctrinated into the sport, and I've loved it ever since, to be honest. And there's no qualms in saying that I wasn't good enough to ever go and play professional.
Yeah, to be honest, that's something which I can definitely relate to, as my play cricket stats will absolutely say for everybody out there who wants to go and see them. Goodness me. Yeah, I never had those dreams, to be honest. I think from a very early age, as soon as I bowled, and I say this story all the time, I bowled 5 wides back to back to back to back to back in a schools game. Yep, that was the England career over. And then, yeah, shortly after that, I was looking at Warwickshire and thinking, goodness me, They don't need my services, otherwise we are most definitely in trouble. So the dreams of the professional cricketer, I'm going to be honest, I never had them. But with that being said, the great thing about cricket is that it's a great game, even if you're not playing it professionally. You know, at the recreational level, the grassroots village level, there's so many fantastic memories to be made, aren't there? On those village greens with some terrible moments. And it is that very cliche adage, but the words, that's so village. And absolutely everybody in this country, even the professionals, because they've had to come up through those systems as well, can relate to that. And that's what I love about the game of cricket. Nobody takes themselves too seriously in those leagues, and you get some absolutely fantastic moments, to say the least. But James, aside from the grassroots stuff then, before we get on to the world of physiotherapy and your journey in the county circuit, one final question about the professional game, and that'd be, who's your favourite ever cricketer? And that is a very, very tough question, I imagine. But if you could have a net session with one cricketer in the history of the game for 2 hours, who would you choose and why?
Wow, that's an unbelievable question with so much choice available. I think one of my cricket heroes growing up was probably because of my Yorkshire background and being a Yorkshire supporter. Darren Lehman was somebody who, he just came over from Australia as our overseas player at Yorkshire and just dominated and just plundered runs in every game. And it was just the style and the way that he did it, which I just completely admired. So I'd probably say Buff would be up there. If I was to name somebody kind of through my adolescent teenage years, that would have been somebody I would have jumped at the chance to have had a net with, definitely.
That's interesting you mentioned that. I can't say that we've had Darren Lehman's name on the podcast so far, because the obvious choices would be the Sachin Tendulkars, the Jacques Callises, the Alistair Cooks, for example. But I suppose with that Yorkshire connection, it's pretty obvious, isn't it, to be fair? And what about in terms of bowlers? Because you mentioned there Darren Lehman, very, very good batsman. But what about bowlers? Well, that, again, might be tough.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, the other name I was nearly mentioned in front of Darren Lehman was Darren Goff. He was very much a superstar when I was 7, 8, 9, coming into that England side as a bit of a firebrand into the England team. And I remember him scoring runs down the order in an Ashes test match at Sydney. I remember listening to it on the radio at home. And yeah, his skill set, the way he played his cricket, the fact he always had a smile on his face, a bit of a cheeky character. It just came across the TV screen so well. And obviously a great stalwart for Yorkshire, and obviously now back in contact with the club and working his magic there, we hope. So yeah, he would be probably the bowler I would pick out.
Fair enough. A great character is Darren Goff, and we've had quite a few stories involving Goffy here on the podcast, the most recent of which was involving him in a taxi. Well, I say a taxi, it was basically Chris Wright's car. But Chris Wright was acting as a taxi driver on this occasion around Chelmsford. Again, listeners, if you want to go and check that out, you can find that on the podcast website. But yeah, Darren Goff, great bowler, great character, great energy, and of course, a legend up in the county of Yorkshire. But aside then from playing days, James, let's go into the world of sports physiotherapy. A very interesting world, it has to be said, because in a way, you are almost an unsung hero for a lot of the fans, because you basically get players back on the right way to recovery. So in terms of the industry itself, why sports physiotherapy? What was it about that career, James, that was so enticing and so appealing to you in the first place?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'll try and answer it in a few stages. I think why physio? Physiotherapy is such a diverse career option for somebody to take on. Diverse in that you can take your skill set and your experiences into so many different environments, which can seem polar opposites. So, for example, in a non-sport setting, you can go and work in a stroke unit and work with a patient who's post-stroke. You could be in intensive care assisting people in intensive care. You could be in an A&E facility, or you could be working in the community, or working in outpatients with people coming in with musculoskeletal problems. So it allows different personalities and different skill sets to come to the fore. So if anybody came to me and said, do you think I could be a physio? I would say yes, because you'll find an area where your strengths lie or where your interest is piqued. So as a career option, I think it's a really good one because it gives you lots of choice. And obviously you can take that, earn your money through going through the public health system. You can go and work in the private health system, or you can go and work in the elite sport industry. And I started in the public health, in the National Health Service, but very quickly moved over to the world of elite sport. And why sport? I mean, sport's been a big part of my life growing up as I tried to get across in from cricket, but keen watcher of all sports. So I initially went to university and studied sports science and physiology as my undergraduate degree. And I chose that because I knew I had an interest in sport. I wasn't clear on where my career was going or what my main interest was going to be. So it was quite a generic choice at that stage. And then it was following graduation that I got the opportunity to go and study the master's in physiotherapy. And at that stage, again, you're not quite sure if you're going to funnel yourself down one of those different industries within physiotherapy. But I think there was a light bulb in the back of my mind that I was thinking, yeah, I'm going to qualify, do some service to the health service, but probably quickly look to try and make that transition. And I got that opportunity handed to me, really. I got a phone call from connections I'd made during a student placement in the world of sport, and an opportunity was given to me. Two roles, really. One was at Castleford Tigers, which was a Super League rugby league club, working with their academy and developing reserve team, and at Yorkshire County Cricket Club, which was a big deal for me because of the connections I've just related to. And they both were part-time, self-employed roles and opportunities, but they were the first kind of foray into the elite sport world. And yeah, I was very much thrown in the deep end, but it provided me with a real interest straight away. I was working with elite sports people in two different sports. It was everything that I was thinking that I wanted to do. And it all just played itself out in front of me. So that was kind of my transition into professional sport. And then it's just kind of grown from there, really, and developed into a career, I hope, and a passion. It does take over you 365 days a year. But it's a great career. It's very, very rewarding. But it's also very challenging as well.
Well, of course it is. And we'll talk about those challenges as well as the positive aspects in more detail in due course. But you mentioned there about the large workload of the career itself, 365 days a year. I know this is a very cliche question, but in terms of the typical day of a sports physio, what does that entail?
I think it depends on the context, but the context for the listener is important. So if I gave you the context of a match day, for example, let's take a four-day county championship match, home or away. If we're away, obviously, usually in a hotel room, you get up and your first interactions with your players is going to be over the breakfast table. So dialogue is already starting to take place at that stage. You're already starting to understand if there's any problems that might arise for that day, or it might be feedback from the previous day in a multi-day format perspective. When you arrive at the ground, it very much depends on what support network you've got that day. So for me, if I'm away from home, sometimes I might not have a strength and conditioning with me. So your responsibilities would include preparing the players with any kind of strapping or taping techniques which they've requested. You would undergo any treatment that you'd agreed with the player, which would facilitate them taking the field at the best 100% function or close to. usually preparing a warm-up. So you've probably got like an hour to an hour and a half window from arrival at the ground to do these things and have a warm-up set up. And then I would tend to deliver that warm-up, which you're just trying to prepare the players physically and mentally for competition. And then it's very much handed over to the coaches about an hour before play. And the coaches would then facilitate the cricket-specific warm-up before start of play. Now, again, in that time, there'll be other requests from players, usually on an individual level. Might need some pain relief. They might need some additional taping that they didn't organise before. They might need some additional treatment. And then from the start time through to the end of play, you're very much focused on the game. You're there to provide an emergency support to the match, but mainly you're there to focus on your team and make sure you're facilitating the players to achieve their maximum performance. Now, that would paint the picture that there are not other things going on during the match play. There often is. So if you're at the GS Bowl, for example, we'll have injured players who will come and see me during a match day. And you're working with the S&Cs and your physio colleagues to try and facilitate their rehabilitation whilst a game's going on. You might have a player who's not been selected who's comes to have a catch-up and wants to understand what the structure of their week should look like so that they're keeping their physical loads turning over so they're ready for match play when called upon. So it's very dynamic as a day. There is a lot of requests. Your door's always open. Obviously, requests can come from players, but they can come from colleagues, coaching staff, occasional supporters. And it's a tiring day. But it's a rewarding day as well. The energy of the morning, those 2 hours in the morning, you get the energy of the match preparation. You can see the guys are buzzing or anxious for the match, and you're trying to get involved in how you can help that. As a cricket badger, I like watching the game as well. So I like to observe the flow of the match and obviously then not forget your primary role of why you're there. And It's one big emotional soup, basically, in a 4-day game, especially away from home. It can take a bit out of you as a cricket physio, I must admit.
I can imagine it does. Yeah, because judging by that passage, I think the word dynamic, that's a great word to use, actually. It's ever changing. There isn't stability, I suppose, because anything can crop up at a moment's notice. I was interested to hear you talk about there, about feedback in the morning. And you mentioned about the ways that you can help. How can you help in that regard? Let's say that one of the boys isn't quite feeling at their best. What steps can you put in place on that day to get them in the right frame of mind to go onto that field and play the game of cricket?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, again, it depends on the context of the concern or the complaint. Often, there's not a physical kind of impediment as to why they're not right. It could be they've had a bad night's sleep, could be a factor. Often it's working on the psychosocial mental elements really with players. This county season is a long season. There's a lot of competition. It challenges the guys, especially guys who are struggling for form. So you're there really to try and support that individual. And usually it's a mixture of empathy, empathizing with whatever situation it is, but really quickly taking that information and reinforcing the positives as quick as you can and refocusing them on the present moment and what the present task is. So communication is a massive element. I think that kind of separates a good physio from a great physio, is to be able to have a player come to them, understand the likely kind of sequence of events for that player to come and see you, and to be able to then unpick that quickly and communicate it in a way which just takes away any anxiety that there might be in that player. And what we know in the world of physiotherapy, in the medical world, is there's a massive connection between pain, physical symptoms and psychological status. So we call it a biopsychosocial approach. It's seeing the player's physical and psychological status as intertwined and interconnected. So when you're working with a player, you're always making sure that your choice of words is correct. You have a reassuring nature. And then on top of that, there might be a physical thing that you need to provide them, whether that be a treatment. It could be a soft tissue treatment. It could be a joint-related treatment. It could be the use of a taping strategy to give them physical or psychological stability to that particular area. But I think that skill kind of develops with experience, both of the profession and the game, but also of that individual you're working with. And that's the beauty of professional sport, is you get to work with the individuals. You know their nuances. You understand what their strengths are. You understand when they're stressed, what their weaknesses are, and you can try and tailor your response to tailor for that particular person.
You absolutely can. And in terms of skills, because again, I'm actually fascinated by this. I must admit, it's not often we get to talk about physiotherapy here on the podcast, so I'm going to try and learn as much as possible today. But in terms of those skills, those attributes, those traits and characteristics, what would you say are the most important attributes that a physio can possess? You mentioned already about communication. I suppose that's with anything in life, though. Clear, concise communication, absolutely integral in this world that we call life. But I'm guessing that trust is also a massive part of it as well, isn't it, in the world of the sports physio?
Yeah, you've nailed it, to be honest. I think I want you to imagine the interface between the player and the physio. And when I'm working with other physios, or if I have students in, I'll often explain to them that the success of the treatment or your intervention can be affected by the way that you behave, the way you present yourself, often in those first couple of minutes when that player comes in to see you, or when that new patient comes in to see you. It's about exuding a confidence. It's having an internal awareness that you are the expert in the room when it comes to that problem. And being able to put that across to the player in a confident but non-arrogant way. But also, I think your questions around what are the drivers for that player? What are those internal drivers as to why that player has come to see you as a physio? If you can unpick that very quickly, I think that's a skill, because there's a reason why that player's come into your office. And they might have had that problem for weeks and weeks and weeks, but there's a reason they came in at that particular moment. And it could be due to the game that they're playing. It could be due to an opponent on the opposition that they're playing. It could be due to the conditions. Could be due to the ground. All these different experiences influence the players in different ways. And you've got to be able to try and extract that information from the player. And if you can pick out what those internal drivers are through your questioning, through your interaction with that player, that's where the trust comes. Because the player immediately or soon realizes that you're in this for their benefit. Because you've asked them the key questions. You've wanted to know what their drivers for them coming to see you are. And then from there, you've got hopefully a strong relationship in which to move forward and determine which intervention or interventions you're going to choose in order to get that player ready for that game or that spell or whatever it is.
Absolutely. I'll tell you what, James, you articulate this absolutely fantastically. And again, I haven't... No, you're doing a great job, mate, honestly. I imagine I'm going to pick up quite a lot from today's conversation. And you mentioned about those treatments, because you mentioned about both the psychological and the physical ones. Obviously, taping is very, very common. We see it all the time in cricket. But what do you say are the most, you know, common treatments that you'll give to players in the world of counter cricket in particular? Is there anything which keeps on cropping up time and time and time again, I suppose, on a day-to-day basis? Or does it vary, I suppose?
Yeah, I think it varies. I think as physios, you want to make sure you've got a toolbox. We refer to it having a skill toolbox or a therapeutic toolbox that you can pick out different things out of your experience and apply those to the world of cricket. I guess for the viewers, we do soft tissue work with players, but whether it be in preparation for or in recovery from a match day. So the fast bowlers after a heavy spell, for instance, or a day in the dirt, as they refer to it as. Some soft tissue techniques just to kind of flush the muscles out can be part of a recovery process, preparation for the next match day. We can do joint work in if somebody's got some joint stiffness and we need to get the joint moving. We can do some what we call joint mobilizations. So, for example, let's use fast bowlers again. Common one would be front foot contact. It's a lot of forces that goes through that front ankle, and you tend to see over weeks of bowling that they get a reduction in the range of motion of that front foot ankle. So we'd like to try and maintain that. So we do a lot of mobilization around a front foot, for example. We like to try and maintain good range of motion through the mid thoracic spine, which is important for batsmen and bowlers in terms of rotation. You mentioned tape, obviously. We would use tape both as a rigid strategy if somebody's got any local instability and we needed to try and protect the joint. But we'd also use that across muscle groups as well if we're needing to give some feedback or some reassurance to the tissue as well. But it's quite diverse. Acupuncture is another thing that we would use as part of a therapeutic process around pain management. But again, I think a lot of it does depend on the player's experience. If you've got a player who comes in and said, oh, I've had acupuncture and it does nothing for me, it's probably not going to work with them. If they've had soft tissue work, then you'll try and facilitate what the player's experience, particularly positive experiences, have been without them creating a space where they've become it becomes necessary for them to do it all the time. But it's a balance, and you work with the player to try and establish what our kind of treatment regimen would be and try and tailor it to that individual. Is that's a critical thing, really, for a player.
Yeah, it certainly is, guessing from that passage. And again, it comes onto that overarching themes of being flexible, isn't it? And tailoring it to the individual. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach in the world of physiotherapy. And you mentioned there about fast bowlers, and we've had a conversation about a particular injury which has plagued English fast bowlers for a number of years now, and that is the stress fracture. It comes up season in, season out. Just to give one prominent example, Warwickshire seam bowler Ollie Stone. He's had an awful lot of issues when it comes to stress fractures. And we did actually have a question from Twitter. I'll use one of these now. Actually, this is from Kristen Burgess, Michael Burgess's brother, the Warwickshire wicketkeeper. And he asked you, James, it seems that nowadays, fast bowlers around the world are far more injury prone now compared to years prior. Why do you think that is? Is it the strain on the body? Is it greater nowadays? Or do you think it's down to action? What do you think is the sole cause of this increase in stress fractures in county cricket?
That's a great question. I don't think there's a very simple answer to the question, but I'll try and get across some of the ideas that come to mind. I think when we're looking at any stress injury, we term it as a bone stress injury. You can get these all over your body. And you rightfully say cricketers, the lumbar spine is probably the most prevalent. In other sports, a navicular bone in the foot, for example, or a metatarsal in the foot can be, or tibial stress fractures. There are many risk factors in athlete populations which might lead to an increased chance of a bone stress injury taking place. And it's our job as physios, in conjunction with the other members of the science and medicine team, to try and reduce as many of these risk factors as possible. So for the listeners, one of the key things with bone is it's an organic tissue. So it very much adapts to the load you apply to it. So if you apply a load to a bone and you apply it in an appropriate way, the bone will adapt and it'll adapt stronger. It'll be better than what it was before you attributed that load to it. what can happen in bone stress injuries is where that load is applied inappropriately. Now, that load can be applied inappropriately because of the magnitude of the force. So if you jumped off a high-story building and tried to land, for instance, the magnitude of that force would be too much. It could be the frequency, so the amount of loading cycles that's been applied to the bone. So imagine, I'll use the foot stress fracture example, as just going and doing skipping for hours and hours and hours per day. Then you might overload the bones in the foot if you continue to skip. And the same analogy is for a fast bowler, is that if you apply the load inappropriately, then you can potentially increase the risk of that person picking up a stress fracture. Problem is what's inappropriate? And that is the big question that researchers and people within the game are trying to work out, because we, on one side, appreciate that you need load for the bone to adapt and the spine to adapt. And if you look at, so the ECB have been very good in giving out information, conducting scans on players and looking at the adaptive changes that take place in fast bowlers. So, for example, Jimmy Anderson and Stuart Broad, if you look at their spines in a scanner called the DEXA scanner, if you look at the left-hand side of their backs, which is the side of the spine which gets loaded as a right-handed fast bowler, their bone mineral density is greater than that of a powerlifter and a heavy weightlifter because of the concentration of forces in a particular area of the spine. Their spine has adapted, and that's provided protection for them over the career and allowed them to have the stellar careers that them both have had. And that's what happens with all fast bowlers. Their spines are always developing through their adolescent years and into their professional years. It's just the way that bone's loaded and how it responds to that load is influenced by so many factors. So I talked about load. We know that nutrition is another thing. Having a good nutrition, having good energy intake, good source of carbohydrates is important for fast bowlers. Not going onto the field with a carbohydrate deficit is another piece of research. Vitamin D status, vitamin D, which we get from the sun naturally, but also through food. There's evidence if you've got poor vitamin D content, then that can be a risk factor. Alcohol content, smoking, the factors go on. So our role as a support team, particularly to the fast bowling kind of network, but also our bowling squad, is to try and, well, okay, we need you to eat well. We want you to avoid drinking alcohol if possible. We will assess their vitamin D status, and we will suggest nutritional interventions. We've got a nutritionist who will provide interventional techniques, well, i.e. recipes, and monitoring of calcium intake being another. And then we work with the coaching staff in a collaborative way, hopefully to decide upon what's the ideal bowling load for that particular player. And that's where the individual characteristics of the player really come into your consideration. The age, the technique, the number of years they've been a professional cricketer versus an amateur cricketer. What do they do in the summer versus the winter? It's so diverse. It's a very dynamic decision-making process. I think my personal experiences have got better and better and better in terms of we're reducing them at Hampshire. And I think it's just through learning about your players who are individually in your squads, but also looking at the ways that you've applied winter bowling programs, how you've applied S&C, your nutrition, your vitamin D status, et cetera, et cetera. So to try and answer the question, why are we getting more injuries now? That's a really tough one, because if people who would say 50s, 60s, all these guys bowled hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of overs. And I think they're really valid points, really valid points. What we do know, even in the last 10 years, is the intensity at which cricket is played is greater than what it was 10 years ago. So we've got GPS information which tells us that. It tells that players cover more distance, they do more high-speed running. You see how the skill element of the game is always adapting, and it's requiring more and more physical expertise, really, in order to perform the sport well. And that does come at a price. And then the different format changes again, that influences the bone loading. So, it's going to take lots more research, more clever people than me. But there are some very good research taking place all over the world in the cricket community that's trying to get to the bottom of this. And we'll never cure this problem. Hopefully we get better at reducing the chances of it happening. And hopefully we get better at rehabilitating this injury.
It's a fascinating field, isn't it? To be honest, it really isn't. And so many factors going into it. I was going to be honest. I didn't expect to hear the words vitamin D when it came into it. I do find that quite fascinating in terms of that content that can actually affect and impact your likelihood of getting a stress fracture. Goodness mate, that's some very, very interesting information to learn. And quite clearly, I think with our stress fracture field, it does go to show just how important those connections within the cricket club are, aren't they, with the nutritionist, the S&C and the physio working together as one unit. But as you said, this is something which can never really be solved. And of course, every single body is different, aren't they? Some will be a lot more prone to these stress fractures, others won't be. It's all about the individual. But it is a very, very interesting facet of the industry, I suppose. And in terms of another one, which I have to talk about, because we spoke to Anirin on the podcast about this at length, another very, very common injury when it comes to sport, not just cricket, but ACL tears. And they are common, but they are absolutely horrible and they take ages to rehabilitate. James, this might be a tough question, but which are more difficult for you as the physio in terms of stress fractures or ACL tears? Which of those is more difficult for you to rehabilitate and get those players back to fighting fitness?
Yeah, they're very different injuries, both at a tissue level, we've got a bone versus a ligament. I guess for the player, both injuries are going to mean a lengthy time away from their sport, and that's the hard thing because there's no win there. For an ACL sufferer, you're looking at 9 months, probably at best now. Some players will get back sooner, but the evidence is suggesting that those who come back too soon can have secondary injury. So 9 to 12 months. For a stress fracture, you can get them back quicker than that period. But as I said earlier, my previous answer is to try and understand, is that the right thing to bring them back earlier? A typical stress fracture could kind of heal within a 3-month period, but then you've got the reloading phase. So in one way, a stress fracture should be back quicker. So for the player, the prospect of an early return is more likely. But with both injuries, they both have a re-injury risk attached to them. So they're both very challenging injuries to deal with. And I'm going to duck the question that you've just asked me, which is the most difficult one. But I'd say an ACL, and you mentioned an iron there, obviously had back-to-back injuries. It's a really terrible injury, but I don't think, as a physio, I should be externally saying that it's an injury you can get back from ACLs. And the rehab for me across the industry is getting so much better. The re-injury rates, I believe, are dropping in ACL rehab. So it's still, both injuries are very much recoverable and rehabilitative in nature.
And that's the important thing. You can come back. Of course, you have to have that positive mindset when you do eventually come back into your sport from those injuries. I will admit that was a very tough question, but that is why I asked it, to be honest. I was just interested to hear it from a physio's perspective. But aside from the most challenging injuries then, before we get on to the Twitter questions, which will offer a completely different dynamic to today's podcast, we mentioned there already about the rewarding nature of the world of physiotherapy and the fact that you are helping these guys out to perform at their best. It's a wonderful thing to do in the world of sports. But on the flip side, knowing that there is all of that workload, there must also be a tremendous amount of responsibility, because if you get those workloads wrong, you're culpable in a way for that player's re-injury. James, in your view, what is the most difficult aspect of the sports physiotherapist? What is the number one challenge facing people in this industry?
That's a great question. I think I'm going to answer it in a slightly different way. I think the first thing I'd say is, yes, there is a lot of responsibility in it. I think that's something you accept when you take the job on. But I think what you learn as you get a bit more experience is there's only so much you can control. So I remember my first experience, my first year at Hampshire, in particular the first 2 months were very challenging. In the first 5 county championship games, I think I had 3 or 4 bowlers leave the game during the first 5 games. That, like, we ended up with a bowler less in those games. And I felt like personally, it felt like I was under attack, not from anybody externally, just internalized. I'm doing something wrong. Why is this happening? What am I going to do? Am I being judged? Not by the players who are injured as such, but you just wonder what the people within the club are thinking, the coaching team, the supporters. And you then start to, you still want to try and prevent injuries, but I've learned not to take them as personally as I probably did at the start. You try your best to provide a preventative strategy, which is try and reduce injuries, but injuries are going to occur. And I've become better and more emotionally rounded and able to deal with that and put it into context. And I think that will probably make it better in terms of how I present myself to that player as and when those injuries occur. So in one way, I think the pressure aspect will always remain a challenge for somebody working in elite sport, but I think that's something that you can learn to deal with and to understand and give yourself context for. And sometimes that might come from an internal learning, or it might be somebody of more experience or a coach who just says, James, it's not all your responsibility, is this? Because when a player gets injured, there can be many reasons for that. And it could be we've overtrained them, and it could be, so it's a collaborative approach as a coaching team. It's not just the physio's fault. But yeah, I guess the hardest part is where you feel you make a decision, a medical decision, which in hindsight is not the right one. And you make a decision based on all the available evidence that you've got, the best information, your experiences, and sometimes it doesn't quite go so well. And I've had that in this role. And I think that's the most challenging thing, because you can start to have a bit of self-doubt. But again, it's about being able to go through a reflective process, just as sports people go through reflective processes about the way that they prepare themselves. As a medical professional, you go through those same processes, and you're encouraged to do so by your governing bodies. So I'd say that's a challenge. I think the workload element is more of a challenge, I think, in professional sport than in perhaps to the public health system, although people may argue in the other direction. But I think that's getting better as well within sport. It's an issue, but it's a discussed issue now. To be honest, I think especially in the last 2 years post COVID, it's a matter. I'm not talking specific to Hampshire. I'm talking across the whole elite sport. I saw some recent very good talks on this on Twitter in football and work-life balance for physios in football. So I think that's probably the most challenging aspect. And I think we have a responsibility to the people who work in these industries to make sure we're still looking at them from a holistic well-being standpoint as well. Because I've been challenged by the workload over 5 years at Hampshire. But that's no detriment of Hampshire. It's just the way that the structure of the season is. But I think it's a developing area which is going in the right direction.
Well, that's the important thing. And that is good to know, of course, for any aspiring physios out there. And James, just before we go on to the Twitter questions, I do just want to backtrack slightly, because in that passage, you mentioned about getting it wrong And it is something important in life, isn't it? That reflection and growing from those bad experiences. Again, for any aspiring physios out there, when have you got things wrong? And I suppose, what were the biggest lessons that you learned from those experiences? I know that's a very tough question, but it might be important for someone wanting to go into this field to have heard that from someone who's been there, done it, and come out on the other side.
Yeah, I think in the nature of working in medicine, you've got choice. Like, when you're presented with an issue, you can look at it very logically, and you've got often two, three, maybe more choices that you can make. And in order to make that information, you try and use experts, you try and use your own experiences, you try and use research. So a big element of what we do is using what we call evidence-based practice. You're taking research which is conducted in the field and apply that to your day-to-day work. So I think that's the really important thing. I've got one or two examples, but I don't want to name players. And one player in particular, you have a decision. And it was an injury which was related to previous question, which is a lumbar stress fracture. And the decision with that player is, do you go for a conservative rehabilitation? So most stress fractures rehab can be rehabbed conservatively, i.e. the stress fracture heals. But you can actually apply a surgical intervention, which is much more rare. There's less research, there's less numbers. But I'd also had a success with another player doing it surgically. And with that particular player, chose to go down the more common conservative approach, and it didn't work, in essence. And the next plan was then to go surgically. That's what happened, and that worked. So then you think, well, could I have been part of a process which prevented going down that initial conservative approach, which failed, and gone down the surgical approach, which has seemed to be successful with that player? And they're the kind of decisions where you reflect on. And you feel comfortable once you've done that reflection that actually you made the right decision at that right time. But it's working with players, it's such a dynamic environment. And things change so much, which can influence the success or failure of their return to injury, for example. So it's not all down to a singular decision, but you do reflect on the influences that you have as a physio to take a player down a certain route or a certain choice of treatment, which sometimes might not be optimal for them. But you want to try and reduce that happening as much as you can, obviously.
Of course. But then again, coming back onto that overarching theme, it's all about experience, isn't it? You wouldn't have known that before that thing has happened. It's all about how you learn from that and improve it. Heading into the future, again, that's something which keeps cropping up again and again and again. And it is a fascinating topic. It really is. And to be honest, James, if you're more than happy to do so, we'd love to get you back on again during the season for a more in-depth chat about this, because yeah, I imagine you got some fantastic, fantastic insight into this field. But I am just aware of the time, because we have got quite a lot of Twitter questions. Actually, I'm looking back on the tweet. We had quite a few. Which shows your popularity, James. You should take that as quite a compliment. But before we get on to the exact Twitter questions, there was another reason why I wanted to get you onto the podcast today, aside from the world of physiotherapy. And this was quite a few episodes back, to be honest, but it's cropped up quite a few times. A certain karaoke performance. So for those long-term listeners, as you'll know here on the podcast, we have our segment called Teammates, where we ask county cricketers about the teammates that they share a dressing room with at their various clubs. And one of those questions is the karaoke king. Now, for Hampshire County Cricket Club, your name, James, has cropped up quite a few times, shall we say, from numerous sources. So in terms of the karaoke performance itself, first of all, what was the song choice, for those who don't know? And second of all, the more important question, what's the inspiration behind that particular choice of song?
Oh, no. I wasn't aware of this information being public, and certainly not within your podcast, so this is news to me. Yes, how can I answer this? The song is Chocolate Salty Balls, which is by Chef, popular from South Park. I have to give you the story now as to why, where this came from. Basically, in 2017 was my first season at Hampshire. We went to Somerset and we beat Somerset in 3 days on a very interesting track, which spun a lot. There was 31 wickets to spin. And the game finished in 3 days. And we went top of the league. And I think it was probably partly a new job, so that I expected to have to do an initiation, a three-day win. And then it was decided upon by the coaching team that we would stay in Taunton that evening. And it was a bank holiday Sunday. And I think the game finished mid-afternoon. So the guys said, look, we're going to get dressed. We're going to have a little celebration in Taunton. So we went to a couple of bars. We had a sports bar. We played some darts, which was the craze at the club at the time. And then we ended up going into Beer Keller in Taunton Town Centre. And I remember walking in and it was clear there was a karaoke night and it was absolutely packed. It was absolutely packed. It was Bank Holiday Sunday. It was 25 degrees. And there were people stood on the tables, as you know, if you've ever been in the Beer Keller. And the lads were saying, come on, this is your time, Cleggy. This is your time to do your karaoke. So I didn't tell them what song I was going to do. So I put my name down to do this song. And I got called up to the stage. And I recall getting up there and thinking, why on earth have I started to do this? Why have I chosen this song? And I don't know if you know the song, but it kind of starts.
I do.
You know the song. No, I'm glad, because I was going to sing it, but I won't do now. And there was silence across the whole place. I remember there was a group of lads in a semicircle in the front of the stage staring at me, like shaking their heads, like, what are you doing? What are you doing, son? And I thought, I've got to go for this now. I've got to give it everything. And I've gone big style. And you could have heard a pin drop apart from a collection of Hampshire players in the far end of the bar. I remember George Bailey stood on the table, giving it the big one. And yeah, it was funny for them. There was a video that was captured, which I've not yet seen. That's the start of the karaoke story, I guess.
It's a very, very unique song. And again, we can't repeat it on the podcast because we are a family show, but the song itself is absolutely hilarious and obviously sung by the late, great Isaac Hayes, who was fantastic as Chef. And the song, I'm pretty sure, I can't remember the music festival he did it at. He sung it at a UK music festival live in front of thousands of people. Do you know which one it was, James?
I think it was
Glasto.
It could have been Glasto. It was number one. I'm sure the song got to number one. So I think that's why he sung it. I think that's why he sung it at Glastonbury. But I definitely remember him doing it in front of a very large outdoor audience. So I have that memory.
Yeah, I've seen the YouTube video. That's why. And I was just thinking, imagine what the people who have never heard this song are thinking as he sings this. It's incredibly rogue. I'm going to be honest. When we usually have the karaoke king, it's usually a case of, you know, Sweet Caroline or, I don't know, a little bit of the Bee Gees, actually. And that's come up before, a little bit of ABBA, you know, all the classics. Respect for that, though. It's a very, very funny song. And yeah, if you want to go and check out on YouTube, please feel free to go and do so at your own discretion. I'm glad we got the background story behind that, James. I'm very happy. But can we expect to see it in the future? Maybe it's at some point in this season.
Well, I actually sang it at, I went back to Fairbairn a couple of weeks ago, and I did sing it again at 60th birthday party, which again was captured on video. I will not be sharing that, but some of the looks that I got from the people in that place was, and I think it's the shock factor that really tickles me. My friends know what's coming, but most of the people in the audience don't, and I think that's, it's something now that will stick with me, and every time there's a karaoke, I promise that I'll always do that song for them.
That's very good to know. I'm going to be honest, James. I think the even funnier thing is that you don't seem like the person who would sing that song. It's the shock factor.
It's the shock factor, yeah. I think that's what I enjoy the most.
Well, we'll keep it up, to be honest. It is absolutely hilarious. Absolutely brilliant, that. I imagine it'll come up in a later teammates episode at some point when we get another one of the lads on, but goodness me, safe to say that was a very, very memorable night in Taunton. But moving on then from that famous karaoke night, which has cropped up a lot of times here on the podcast, let's go on to the main Twitter questions. And we'll start first and foremost with this one from a fan favourite here at TCCP, Mr. Jake Lintott, Agent Lintott, as we know him here on the Counts Cricket podcast. Big up to Jake. Absolutely lovely fella. And Jake's question to you, James, is describe what supporting Leeds United is like in three words.
In three words? Very, very challenging.
I'm surprised with that. I thought you could have just gone with marching on together. That's the close motto, isn't it?
No, it's everybody knows it's a bit of a roller coaster club to support, and no more so in the last couple of weeks. But he's the first person, Jake, who will text me if Leeds are getting beat. We got absolutely smashed recently, and he was texting me throughout, and I just completely blanked him because he knows he gets them.
He talks at large, doesn't he, Jake, when it comes to football? And a reminder of who he supports, Exeter City, isn't it?
I actually don't know who he supports.
He's an Exeter fan, James. He supports really the Grecians, yes.
Oh, I look forward to using that in the future.
There you go. That's ammo. That's your rebuttal for the future. If Exeter are losing, text that to Jake. See what his reaction is. But moving on to our next one then. Aside from the wonderful game of football and Agent Lintott, let's move on to Fairburn, because I did say that they would crop up again in today's podcast. Our first question is from Nye Donald, and he asks, how many runs are you going to score for Fairburn Cricket Club in the 2022 season?
Well, first and foremost, I'm going to try and get back in the team, to be honest. I haven't played for 5 years, so when I go back on previous kind of weekends, I've tended to be in the second team. So I've got to try and get in the first team if I can. And then I've got to try and make sure I play regularly enough. I'm usually good for 20. I'm very, very good against 20, like one of the most consistent players in world cricket against 20. It's getting past 29 usually is the struggle. But incredibly consistent against that new ball, if you need me.
The comfortable 20s, the nervous 30s. Very much a case of that.
Absolutely.
I wish that was the case of me. It's more like the comfortable twos and then the nervy threes. Can never get that third run, to be honest. Batting at number 10, that's something which a lot of tail-enders, I'll say a lot of tail-enders, you're probably a lot better than me, but we all share that experience, don't we? Goodness me. Yeah, if only I could bat. Right then, moving on to our next one. This is also about Fairburn, but this is a bit of a nostalgia trip, courtesy of Gloucestershire seam bowler Josh Shaw. And Josh didn't actually mention this on Twitter, but he messaged us. He sent us a DM. He said, ask James if he remembers breaking my bathroom window in a Fairburn versus Street House match. So, James, first and foremost, do you remember that? And secondly, what on earth is the context behind that? How did you break his bathroom window?
Yeah, so obviously Josh Shaw of Gloucestershire now, previously of Yorkshire, he lives... or his parents live basically next to Street House Cricket Club, which is a cricket club in the league that Fairburn no longer play in. And I knew that, but I didn't know exactly which house it was. And I was batting, and I remember their opening bowlers pitched one up, and I've probably played one of the best cricket shots I've ever played, like in terms of straight over the top, high elbow, straight over the side screen, over the bowler's head. And it's gone straight into somebody's, it's crashing through somebody's bathroom window. And I was like, oh no. And it wasn't until I got out that I started doing the normal process of lapping the ground that Josh Shaw came out with a cricket ball. He was like, Cleggy, I can't believe this is you. And it just happened to be Josh Shaw's bathroom window.
Oh my goodness. That's why you don't live next to a cricket field, isn't it?
You should know better. He should know better.
Very true. Board up the windows. That's something which you could do when there's a cricket match on. Just some advice for anyone who does live next to a cricket field. I'm just looking actually, James, that you're at the play cricket stats for Fairburn. 26 career sixes. So that was one of them, and it ended up in Josh Shaw's bathroom. What a hilarious place to hit a six. I mean, that's
that must have been filtered down. I'm sure there's been many more than 26, but we'll go with that.
Well, again, we can actually read out the exact stats. 3 ducks, which actually isn't bad, to be fair. 26 sixes, 276 fours. Do you reckon some of those were sixes and they've just been counted as boundaries?
No, I'll go with it. That seems reasonable enough.
1950s, 3 centuries. An average which, to be honest, I could only dream of, 33.85. That's not too bad at all, Cleggy.
I mean, I'm actually quite happy with that. But like I say, I was very, very consistent in getting to 20s and 30s. I would do that very often, but I'm just never quite good enough to turn them into big scores often enough. And it must be a concentration thing. I get very excitable, I think, when I get to 20 or 30 and start thinking I'm Viv Richards and I'm not Viv Richards. And that's where it usually goes wrong. But now I'm quite happy with those statistics. I'll take those.
Yeah, they're not bad. It's a lot better than my average. 11.5, but we digress. That needs to improve in 2022, let's just say that. But moving on then to our next question. And this one, again, talking of context, I'd love to know the context behind this. This is from Joe Maiden, Hampshire's analyst. And he asks, James, what are your thoughts on using a sledgehammer on a tyre power hitting training? # hit own shin.
Oh, this is quite a comical story and video again, which I hope never goes out to press. Basically, Kyle Abbott, one of the many South African players I've had the fortune of working with, one of his training methods involved him, to prepare himself to bowl in the winter, involved him buying a sledgehammer and using it against a big kind of tractor tyre, which we have located in the gym at the Aegeus Bowl at Hampshire. And basically, I remember being in the gym and he would set it up at one end of the gym and he would absolutely smash it down to the other end of the gym. And he knew, and he wanted to goad me in some way by creating a challenge. He was like, Cleggy, I'm going to give you so many seconds and you're going to smash this sledgehammer against this tractor tyre and see how far you can get it. And we'll furthest distance wins. So I'm like, yeah, okay, no worries. And the first go, I got it. And I didn't even know if I was going to go from a right hand or a left hand. I didn't quite understand what my technique was going to be. And I think Kyle said to me, I had to go from a left-handed perspective. So it was completely, I had no kind of coordination of the task at all. And I've gone to hit the tyre and I've kind of hit the edge of the tyre, but most of the swing and the momentum was coming, smashed my right shin, like fully cracked into my shin. And I've got the videos. It was filmed, unfortunately, and it's gone around the Hampshire WhatsApp group many times. It's a GIF which comes out at every opportunity. That's Joe Maiden, the analyst, saying hit own shin.
Goodness me. What a story that is.
So?
Yeah, I was going to say, did that not require any further treatment on that? Sledgehammer to the shin.
It really did hurt, but I took it, if you see the video, I took it really well. If you see my legs, it's a wonder they didn't just disintegrate under the blow.
That's what I was thinking, a sledgehammer to the shin. Oh my goodness, that's painful. Who made it a GIF? Because that's really hilarious.
Mason Crane loves making GIFs. Me and him, to be honest, he's got me into it, actually. So me and him, we must have got 150 GIFs from various Hampshire-related things. And these are the things you've got to do to pass the time in a long county championship season. And, he will often send me that round. Scott Curry is another Hampshire teammate who enjoys a GIF, and he did send that to me in the last 4 or 5 days, actually.
What's the funniest one I know some of them. We can't exactly delve into the secret ones in the Hampshire WhatsApp group, but aside from yourself here in your own shin with a sledgehammer, again, what the context of that would be is quite funny for those who don't know. But what do you say is the funniest gif that the Hampshire boys operate in that WhatsApp chat?
Oh, there's some absolute classics. I think one of the funniest ones was actually Brad Wheel. I don't know if you recall, he was once caught on Sky Sports. He was 12th man, and he was at the side of the, it was at the GS ball, and the ball was rolling towards him, and he's walking back, and he's tripped over all the equipment at the side of the field, and he's gone legs over head, and that's been made into a gif, and that's probably the cleanest, funniest one that I can share with you.
Fair enough. That's a good one, to be fair. I'm going to be honest, we've had so many Hampshire players on this podcast that that's never come up. I didn't realise that the club was so into their gifts. Interesting to learn that.
There's some outstanding gifts.
Oh, I can imagine there are. Again, it's just part and parcel of cricket, isn't there? You do find some, I bet there's some rogue ones as well, aren't there?
Yeah, there really is.
Yep, that's the game of cricket for you, goodness me. Fair play though, and fair play to Mason Crane for immortalising it in gif form. Moving on to our next question then, we go to Mark Abdi. And Mark's question for you, James, is, James, do you still cite your high school biology / chemistry teacher as your biggest inspiration for getting into physiotherapy?
Oh, no. Is that a genuine question?
It is.
I've got to be careful how I answer that question. He's relating to an incident. There's two parts to the story. One I cannot mention, but it's just a childhood memory. Mark is one of my, not my, one of my best friends, and he's recalling an incident at high school where I picked up. We were doing some, I think it was metal work, and we were burning different metals, and it was too hot to go in like a Bunsen burner, so we had to put it in this thing called a crucible.
Yeah,
which was like a metal kind of concave dish.
Yep.
And we had to blowtorch it, and it blowtorched till it went cherry red and then white hot, and in order to get this particular metal to burn for whatever reason this science experiment was. And at the end of it, you were meant to use the old kind of pliers to pick up the, and I've completely forgot because it was no longer white hot or red hot, and I've picked it up. And I've the normal human reflex is to grip it harder, and you can smell literally my skin. And I just remember Mark Abdi, the whites of Mark Abdi's eyes staring at me. It's like the world slowed down, and he's looking at me going, "You've not just picked that up, James Clegg, have you?" And it was the particular biology teacher who came to my aid. And the other part of the story I can't mention. So it's just it's a very silly moment that I think sits when we have a drink together, me and Mark, we do reflect on that, one of the silliest things I've done, where you just, there was no logic to that decision.
Do you want me to be completely honest? When I read that question, I thought Mark was your previous biology or chemistry teacher.
No. He wasn't. It's been a bit risque with that question. Which is why I can't go into the full details as to, wouldn't be appropriate for a family show.
Exactly. Fair enough, James. That's fair enough. But moving on to our final question for today's podcast, really. And this is from Gary Oliver, Pompey Gaz on Twitter, massive Hampshire fan, always sends in some excellent questions to us here at the Counter Cricket Podcast. And Gary asks, Hampshire playing Yorkshire in a county match. James, who would you prefer to win?
Yeah, I did see this question. I messaged him like, Gary, what are you doing? Hampshire.
Really?
Hampshire. Yeah, honestly, I'm going to get so much stick from some of the Yorkshire guys for this. I'm a proud Yorkshireman. I've supported Yorkshire all my life. But once you get working in the environment and you get invested in it, then I'll support Hampshire. We've played Yorkshire in county championships. We played him in the semi-final. My dad came in his full Yorkshire regalia to the Aegeus Bowl in 2018. And I was all over Hampshire winning that game. I'll leave the club in 4 or 5 weeks' time to take on another opportunity, but I'll always support the club. I'll always support Hampshire. I am going to watch Yorkshire versus Hampshire at Scarborough this summer, and I do wonder who I'm going to support, but I think I'll probably be a neutral for that one. But it's definitely taken a big place in my heart. It's been a fantastic experience.
Well, that's absolutely brilliant here, James. It really is. And judging from those questions and judging by the things which have cropped up on various podcasts, I think you've left quite the impression on the Hampshire lads. So I think you can be incredibly proud of your time down on the South Coast. And just before we say our final goodbyes for today's episode, James, what does the future hold for yourself? You mentioned there you are unfortunately leaving the club to pursue another venture. But in terms of the foreseeable future, what does life hold and have in store for Mr. James Clegg?
Well, it's a return to my homeland. It's a return to hopefully getting in the Fairburn first team. Me and my long-term partner will hopefully settle, have children in Yorkshire, and I will continue to do fantasy cricket leagues online or via newspapers and continue to support cricket all over the world. Then probably become a scorer or an umpire in my later years, and then hopefully have my ashes spread somewhere over Fairburn Square.
Wow, so very, very much community driven then. I mean, it's not. I'm going to be honest, James. When I said the near future, I didn't quite expect you to have that nice, neatly laid out plan for life in general. But fair enough, mate. And obviously, us lot here at the Counter Cricket Podcast wishing you all the best of luck in your remaining time down on the south coast with Hampshire. And fingers crossed you get back into that Fairburn first 11 as well and improve those play cricket stats again. When we have the follow-up episode, we'll be checking those at the end of the season. So hopefully the average of 33.85 will increase by the time of that episode. But James, that is basically it for today's episode of the Counter Cricket Podcast. Just before we, you know, say goodbye and end today's recording, do you have anything to plug or promote? Any social media channels, websites? Anything like that?
Well, you've caught me there. No, I don't think I do. I think we just promote your excellent, what you guys are doing. I think it's superb. And hopefully we'll have a full quality season of County Championship cricket this season.
Absolutely, James. It's going to be a great season. I've absolutely no doubt about that. Fingers crossed the weather stays okay. That's the only thing with the weather here in England and Wales. It's a little bit dynamic, shall we say. It can change. It's obviously not ideal if it's raining all summer, but hopefully the weather gods are kind. We can have a full season, a full summer of county crickets. And again, just as we say in every single podcast, if you are in the local area of one of these counties, get yourself down to the ground, support your local county, and yeah, just watch some of this incredible cricket that we've got on display for us here in England and Wales across the summer of 2022. But that is basically it from us two here at the Counter Cricket Podcast for today's episode. To all of you wonderful listeners out there, thank you very much for tuning in. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.